Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Marcel Cartier. This week we have a very special edition of Liberation Radio as we bring you two segments from the brand new radio show Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Loud and Clear with Brian Becker is aired 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik in over 60 countries and at radiosputnik.com. Today we want to bring you two segments from a recent episode of Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. The first focuses on the Kurdish issue as we're joined by Elif Sarıkan of the Kurdish Student Union. She discusses with Brian what's been happening in Eastern Turkey and why the Kurdish groups have been excluded from Syrian peace talks. Later we'll be joined by Kim Ives for an analysis of what's happening in Haiti with the recent uprising. But first we go to Elif Sarıkan and what's happening in the Kurdish regions of the Middle East.
I think it's just so shocking that the United States media has been showing images and pictures of Kobani, the fight that have been launched by Kurdish militias and Kurdish military forces. The whole media in the United States has treated the Kurds as a heroic force, and now it comes time to discuss a possible resolution of the Syrian civil war, and the same people, the same Kurdish forces, are excluded. I mean, how is that possible?
I mean, firstly, yes, they have been heroic, and they have, I mean, I would say, been the sole reason why in Kobane, ISIS was defeated. It's been shocking for all of us that they are not being included in the Syrian peace talks in Geneva. But the reason behind this, I would say, is the Turkey-EU relations currently, and that Turkey has vowed to the EU that they will keep the refugees out of Europe. I mean, this has been very important for the EU, of course. And Turkey has been very smart about blackmailing the EU about this situation. So you either give us what we want or we send the refugees your way. I think it's at this stage, it's as simple as that. And I mean, of course, historically, the economic and geopolitical position of Turkey has also made it difficult for the EU to be able to challenge Turkey, but even more so now due to the refugee situation. I mean, recently they received 3 billion euros from Germany, and I'm sure they're going to be receiving more, perhaps from other countries or just in the coming future. But I think that is the main reason why the PYD has not been included, because of course Turkey does not want Kurds to gain any power or strength in the region because this challenges their authority.
Okay, I understand, and I think people who are paying attention understand. Turkey is in fact slaughtering Kurds in Turkey and elsewhere. We know that the Turkish government, the Erdogan government, is at war against the Kurdish organizations and the Kurdish people. But what about the Americans? I mean, the United States, I want to ask you to address this. And I understand what you're saying, that Turkey has some sort of leverage over the EU. If you don't go along in our demand to exclude the Kurds, we will let another mass migration of refugees from Syria or the Middle East enter European territories. But what about the Americans? What's the position of the United States government, of the Obama administration, on the issue of the exclusion of the Kurds?
I mean, as we all know, Turkey is a NATO member. And as I briefly mentioned, their geopolitical position in the region is key for US at the moment, and I think has been for some time now. And they cannot lose Turkey as an ally, so therefore they cannot upset Turkey. I mean, that, and at the same time, what the PYD stands for, I would say, and perhaps this may be a conversation for another day, because it's not as simple as I will put it right now, but what the PYD stands for directly challenges everything that the US is built on. So ideologically, it wouldn't also benefit the US for the PYD to gain any more strength or power in the region and to implement their ideologies, which is democratic confederalism, which is the inclusion of all the people in the region, which is, I mean, I would say, and I'm sure most people would say, the only solution to the Middle East. But this will mean stability in the Middle East, which, of course, I'm sure, as we know, will never benefit the US, because they feed off the instability of the US. I mean, of the Middle East, they feed off this instability. It has benefited them for many years. We saw from Iraq, we've seen from many places. And again, Syria, the instability of Syria, I mean, this is what benefits them. They need instability in the region to have their power, and of course to be able to inflict whatever they want in the region.
The Obama administration has shifted its rhetoric and, in fact, its position on Syria, say compared to where it was in August, September 2013, or starting in 2011 when the demand was Assad must go. That was the only mantra. All of the armed groups were considered to be freedom fighters. There was no talk of ISIL. There was no talk of ISIL or Al-Qaeda or the Army of Conquest posing an existential threat to the United States or to the region. There was no talk about it at all. It was always just Assad must go. But now the United States, following the Russian military intervention in Syria, has shifted first its rhetoric and then its actual position, and now seems to want to have a negotiations, some level of ceasefire, finally an election for a government, perhaps a government of national unity, who knows what kind of government. But the demand isn't first and foremost that Assad must go. So you can see that there has been an adjustment based on the failure of the earlier policy. And now the United States seems to want to resolve the crisis in Syria. Are you saying they actually have no interest in solving the crisis?
I think, of course, we could go deeper if we wanted. But I think on the surface, the main motivation behind the US. So, of course, at first it was Assad must go, because they couldn't make Assad do what they wanted. I think it was as simple as that. And once they saw, okay, things are a bit more complicated in Syria. There's all these forces all around Syria creating mayhem. And I think their motivation at first to get involved was, you know, they're seen as the big dog of the world. They're seen as the most powerful. And I mean, of course, they love that name. They are the most powerful state in the world. And especially after ISIS challenged them, they thought, no, we can't. We need to show the world that no, we are the most powerful. And I think at this stage, especially after Russia's got involved, and they were, I mean, of course, as everyone saw, they were a lot more effective than the US have been over the past few years. And again, that's challenging their reputation. They have to be the most effective and the most powerful in the world. So anything, firstly ISIS and now Russia, that has challenged their reputation and their name, this is their motivation behind wanting to perhaps some sort of a solution. But the solution isn't for humanitarian reasons or because they want people to live peacefully or they genuinely want a solution. It's just they want to be the people behind some sort of action in the world, because they want to be seen. And I mean, I'm saying they, I'm personalizing the whole state, but the US want to be seen as the saviors of the world.
Right. So failing to militarily topple the Assad government, checkmated in that effort, recognizing that this can't be done, that earlier policy has failed, that they are now the overseers of a process maintaining their capacity as the top dog, as you said, or the sole superpower left in the world, the ones able to perhaps dictate a new kind of outcome. I want to ask you about the Syria's PYD, or the Democratic Unity Party. They haven't been invited to the Geneva talks. If they had been invited to the Geneva talks, what would their orientation be in terms of a negotiated end to the war and a transition to a new Syria? What would that new Syria look like?
I mean, firstly, I would like to clear out that they are not a strictly a Kurdish party. The ideology of the PYD is, in its simplest phrase, democratic confederism. And if we are going to defining that or explaining what democratic confederism is, and like I mentioned earlier on, I mean, I think if we do understand it, it's pretty evident and clear that it's the only solution for the Middle East, is that their orientation would be, inclusiveness, all people, I mean, in the simplest form, all people to live peacefully together, no nation states, a bottom-up structure where there's local assemblies, and then it kind of expands out from there. So the bottom-up, the people govern themselves. I mean, essentially, it's the real definition of democracy, you know, governed by the people, for the people. I mean, democracy is, of course, thrown out everywhere in the Western states, but the real idea of democracy is what the PYD would want to implement and what their direction would be in Syria.
Right. And actually, that was going to be my next question, but you've answered it. So that's good. So just so our listeners can understand, we have a big U.S. audience, but also a global audience. The PYD, the Democratic Unity Party, may have an anchoring position within Kurdish communities, but it's not a Kurdish party per se, in the sense that it wants to build a multinational, multi-ethnic unity with Arab people and other people of other identities for a new democratic Syria. It's something along those lines.
Yes, indeed.
What is the Turkish government doing right now to the Kurds in eastern Turkey, and what's its orientation towards the Kurds in particular, and the Kurdish organizations in Syria? Talk about that.
Okay. So, I mean, what the Turkish state is doing in Turkey right now, and I mean, it is useful to discuss this in its historical contents, but I mean, it's not necessary, but just briefly, the Kurdish people have been oppressed within Turkish borders since the existence of the Turkish Republic. So since Turkishness, or the Turkish Republic, was formed, all ethnic minorities, and I mean, in this case, in our question, it's Kurdish people, have been oppressed and denied. I mean, before, their existence was even denied. They were classified as mountain Turks, and you're just an extension of Turks, but, you know, more barbaric and less human. Essentially, again, I don't want to expand on this too much, but essentially what Hitler did with the Nazis, so dehumanize those people, so it justifies basically doing whatever you want to them. And what it's doing right now is, after the 7th of June elections, when the AKP government didn't get the majority that they were so hoping for, so the Turkish President Erdogan can build his presidential system and just have sole power. Of course, he didn't like the results. So, okay, let's go for another election. And the lead up to the November 1 snap election was, I would say, the most bloody election campaign of, I mean, of course, we can't apply this to the world, but in Turkish history, I mean, from bombings to arrests to murders, anything that can make an election campaign bloody, that's what was done. And in the end, they got what they wanted. They got their majority. I mean, luckily, not quite enough to be able to change the constitution to a presidential system alone, just as the AKP party, the government. But they got that. And the reaction of the Kurdish region, and especially the Kurdish youth, was this government doesn't represent us. They're oppressing us. They're killing us on a daily basis. We want to declare autonomy. We want to govern ourselves. So as a symbolic representation of declaring autonomy, the youth in the Kurdish region started building these trenches. And the reaction of the Turkish state was curfews. So, which is actually against their justification of these curfews in the regions are against their constitution and national law. But of course, who's going to tell them what when they are the government themselves and they control everything in the country? So what they have been doing, there's at the moment, there's 52 curfews, 24-hour curfews in 52 different municipalities in Kurdish regions, and people cannot leave their houses. So essentially, they're starving because they, of course, can't go out to get food. They weren't expecting these curfews. So they're starving. Any kids or any women who go out in their garden or go out and try and buy bread are killed with snipers. As we speak, there's 24 people stuck in a basement in the town of Cizre. It was 30, I would say, a few weeks ago, but six of them have died of blood loss because when they reported, so ambulances can come and take them, instead of ambulance, more special team forces arrived, and the four floors of the five-story building that was already destroyed, the last floor was destroyed, so there's no entrance to the basement anymore. So as we speak, these 24 people are still stuck. And of course, we don't know what's happened to them. I mean, they may all be dead by now. We don't know. We don't know if they're going to be saved, how they're going to be saved. There's 24 people still alive alongside bodies of six dead people who died from blood loss. So they're all in one basement waiting to be rescued. So this is the extent of what the Turkish state is doing in the Kurdish region. It's a massacre. That's what it is.
Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation. PSL believes the only solution to the crisis of capitalism is the socialist transformation of society. Imperialist war, unemployment and poverty, deteriorating healthcare, housing and education, racism, discrimination and violence based on gender and sexual orientation, environmental destruction, all are inevitable products of the capitalist system itself. For the great majority of people in the world, including tens of millions in the United States, conditions of life and work are worsening. There is no prospect that the situation can or will be turned around if continued in the current direction. The Party for Socialism and Liberation believes there is a better way. As the world is now, big capitalist owners, a tiny fraction of the population, dominate society. PSL believes only when the wealth of society is owned by the many who created it, rather than the few who now hold legal title to it, will it be possible to speak about democracy in a realistic way. PSL welcomes new and veteran activists and organizers from all walks of life. For more information, visit pslweb.org or connect on Twitter or Facebook. /PSLweb, Liberation, PSL's newspaper, is online at liberationnews.org.
We're turning to Haiti. An uprising has been sweeping Haiti as protesters have been demanding new elections amid allegations of voter fraud in the first two rounds of elections that were held on August 9th and October 25th. A third round had been planned for January 24th, but were canceled after tens of thousands of people took to the streets in the country's capital of Port-au-Prince. What's happening in Haiti today and where is the country headed? We are joined on Skype by Kim Ives, a journalist who has just left Haiti. Ives has been a reporter and journalist with the newspaper Haiti Liberté and is a documentary filmmaker based in Brooklyn. He's now in the Dominican Republic. Welcome, Kim Ives.
Thank you, Brian.
Tell us about the latest. What's going on? What happened on January 22nd?
Well, January 22nd was an historic day. Tens of thousands of Haitians poured out into the streets. They began their march in Port-au-Prince and marched up to Pétionville, which is really where the bourgeoisie of Haiti has its shops and homes. And they went into the streets there and torched cars, set up burning tire barricades, threw telephone poles and boulders in the streets, basically scared the daylights out of the bourgeoisie. And this led, along with the refusal of the second place candidate, Jude Celestin, to take part in the election, to the third round, the January 24th rounds, cancellation. And this was a huge victory, psychological, and I think it's the beginning of a revolutionary period in Haiti, a lot like we saw in Russia a century ago.
Well, that's very traumatic. So let's talk about the current president. When does his term of office end? Please characterize Michel Martelly politically. Where is he coming from? What's his ties to the old regime? Who is he?
Well, Michel Martelly is a neo-devaluerist. He was a cheerleader for the two U.S.-backed coup d'états against former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 1991 and in 2004. He was a sort of lewd compa. Compa is the a form of Haitian popular music. He was a lewd compa singer, the kind of guy who would pull down his pants on stage and do all sorts of lewd acts. And he really brought with him a lot of the children of the Duvalierist Makut class that surrounded Jean-Claude Duvalier and François Duvalier. They teamed up with the bourgeoisie, who was represented by his prime minister, Laurent Lamothe, and set up what the Haitians call a Makuto-Bourgeois alliance, which essentially put back in place the same program that Jean-Claude Duvalier had 30 years ago, which is let's build up Haiti's tourism and sweatshops. This did not last very long or fare very well under Jean-Claude Duvalier, and it didn't work under the Lamothe Martelly regime either. In addition to that, tremendous corruption, tremendous repression, and just a sort of an arrogant attitude towards the population, towards the press, and towards, we could say, the Haitian people in general.
For people who are younger and who are not Haitian, they may not know that much about the Duvalier period. The Duvaliers were, of course, very strongly supported by the United States, but it was a real bloody dictatorship. Try to take us back to what things were like when Martelly's partisans, the Duvalier groups, the Makuts, had the rule.
Well, when they ruled Haiti, it was a reign of terror. People were scared to talk in public. They would whisper. They were just completely cowed. I mean, this was a man who studied Machiavelli, who understood how to create terror. He would, for instance, go to the funeral of somebody who his Makuts had killed and steal the body. He would machine gun whole families after he'd burned their homes. He would once told somebody at the prison, divide the prisoners. We have too many prisoners. Divide them in half, the ones that we should execute and the ones we should keep. When he got there, he said, okay, you're going to switch the two groups. And, you know, this was the kind of arbitrary, ruthless, terror-minded, extended the whole Duvalier period from 1957 until 1986, was just about as bad.
Kim Ives, you just wrote an article for Haiti Liberté in which you said that the Martelly government, the current government that's due to leave office but threatened with this revolt, might resort to death squad tactics. In other words, a death squad solution to the current crisis, similar to what the Duvalier reign of terror meant for the people in Haiti. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, I think we are returning to the Duvalier period, or they are going to attempt to. They are faced with a popular uprising, with tens of thousands of people in the street. The situation is moving very, very fast. And I think that the only way is to deploy terror in an effort to break the spirit of the people. We saw this in El Salvador in the 1980s, and we saw it in Nicaragua and Guatemala, and we saw it in Haiti as well. We've seen it in many countries. Deploy the death squads, create confusion. I just came from Haiti, and a police source there explained to me that there was a meeting on Monday at the National Palace where they distributed money, guns, and cars to a death squad to go out and kill popular organization leaders, and in addition to kill middle-of-the-road politicians and blame it on the opposition. This will create a pretext, of course, for more repression and create confusion. So I think we can expect the Martelly group and with its devaluerist roots to resort to the tactics that we saw under Papa Doc and Baby Doc.
The Obama administration seemed to be pushing Haiti to go forward with these elections that have been denounced and condemned by people as being fraudulent. But of course, the elections are now postponed. Talk about the role of both the U.S. government, the State Department, and the Clinton family in Haiti's political affairs.
Well, it's all intersected in some ways. The Clintons have claimed to have adopted Haiti, that they went there on their honeymoon, which is another half-truth. It wasn't their honeymoon. It was actually the second trip after they were married. But Hillary Clinton had a role in putting Michel Martelly in power. He, in fact, came in third in the vote on November 28, 2010. But Hillary Clinton flew to Haiti in January of 2011, right when the Egypt uprising was in full swing, and read the Riot Act to then-President René Préval and said that his anointed successor, Jude Celestin, who is also the second place finisher in today's election, that he needed to step aside and let Martelly come in. This was because they were uncomfortable with the ties that Préval had with Havana and Caracas. And in addition, Caracas had apparently offered to provide $25 million for Jude Celestin's second round bid against then front runner Merland Maniga.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of Liberation Radio. Once again, I'm your host, Marcel Cartier. If you liked what you heard, be sure to tune in again next week. And also check out Loud and Clear with Brian Becker 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik or SputnikNews.com. Follow the Loud and Clear Facebook page at facebook.com/loudandclearBrianBecker. Check us out on Spreaker and at iTunes with daily podcasts. We'll see you again soon.